Okay, so we'll get started, and we have a substitute for Bill. We're playing the substitute card, and Bhutan has kindly agreed to lead the chanting of the Metta Sutta.
This is what should be done.
By one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise will later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Bill has another job, Bhutan. That's the one. Okay. So, whatever your meditation subject may be, just focus your attention on on that subject. Take a few seconds, a few minutes, just to calm your mind down. Because listening to Dhamma should always be done with a calm mind. Then as the Dharma enters into your heart, you'll have a deeper understanding than simply trying to understand the words. Because Dharma is beyond words. Now, I'll ask you a question. Huh? One person can answer, doesn't hurt. How many people have we got here tonight in this room?
13, including the teacher.
13, including me. Does everybody agree that there are 13 people in this room? Any disagree?
Well, we haven't counted them, so.
13.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so everybody agrees. See, everybody's wrong. You know why everybody's wrong?
It's 14.
Ah. No, there's none. There's none. See, the conventional world says there are people here sitting in this room. Now, the conventional world is made up, as I've said before, of suppositions that we make about the world that we live in. It's called Samuti Satcha in Pali, at the time of the Lord Buddha. And then there's Arya Satcha, which is the real truth, the ultimate truths, if you like, the noble truths. Essentially, what we have in this room is a bunch of elements that are functioning in a certain way, driven by external forces. Some internal forces, if you like, also, the forces of one's own citta, one's own heart, one's own mind, one's own thinking. But even that's fleeting. There's no substance to that. And even that's driven by cause and effect. And the Buddha saw that. When he looked out at the world, he didn't see it the same way we did, the same way we do. We think there's 13 people sitting here. And he would say in the conventional world, that's the right answer. But in the real world, it's just a bunch of animated elements that perform functions. They come together, they coalesce in a certain way. They last for a while. And then they split up and go their own way and form and do something else. And that's the real insight into the world. This world is an illusion. It's here, it tricks us. Well, we trick ourselves, basically. The world, it doesn't really trick us. It's the way we look at it where the trick happens, where the delusion takes place. The four elements don't wake up in the morning and say, I think I'll fool humankind today. There'll be 13 people sitting in that room in Kelmscott and I'll make their day by fooling them and letting them think that they're doing something smart. Now, the air element doesn't think that. The earth element doesn't wake up and think, I'll just fool everybody today and see how they go. Same with the water element. Same with the fire element. They are what they are. That's their nature. The forces bring them together. They last for a while. They break up and go their own separate ways and then come back again in some other form. But we foolishly believe that there is a person here. And that's where all the problems start. Because we then talk about me and mine. What belongs to me doesn't belong to somebody else. This is where we start to have problems. Because now we have wanting, we have desire to maintain those things which we think belong to us. We want to accumulate more things. Things, especially those things and experiences that we believe will bring us happiness. And we want to get rid of all of those things which we think are bringing us suffering and pain. Again, more delusion. These are this view, this wrong view, this is caused because of the fact that we have a heart that's full of kilesa, full of ignorance, full of greed, full of hatred and delusion. In the conventional world, kilesa rule the roost. They are the kings of deception. And we who are unwise fail to see that deception. And most people go right the way through their whole lives and aren't even aware that there's a chance to break through that deception and that delusion. But the Buddha did. And not only did he break through with his wisdom, he taught the way for all of us to break that delusion. He laid down a path to practice, and he gave us some tools with which we can apply ourselves to try and understand and come to grips with the delusion. Because let's face it, a lot of people, if they heard me say what I've just said, they'd be calling for men in white jackets. They think, what on earth is this person talking about? Because they're so stuck in the conventional world. Their hearts reach out, grasping everything, every sensual experience they can get hold of. They want sweet sounds, sweet tastes, nice things to look at, nice things to touch, sweet scents to smell. Delusion, all of it. We look at another person and we think to ourselves, ooh, that person is beautiful, or that person's handsome, or, oh yes, they've got a fine figure. But what does that person consist of? What does that body consist of? If you scrape beneath the surface, peel off the skin, how beautiful would that body be? See it in your mind's eye. Peel off your own skin and throw it down on the floor and see whether what's underneath is really desirable. I mean, in this thing we call the skin, people say, oh, you've got nice skin. Or, oh, don't you look youthful? And yet, if we don't look after it, after a day or two, this nice skin that we think is so beautiful starts to become pretty whiffy. And we have ointments to look after it, and we have, you know, not only do we need soap and water to keep it clean, we need perfumes to make it smell nice, because its own nature is it's foul, it's disgusting. That's the nature of the skin. That's the nature of things that break down and decompose. But the skin is always decomposing. It's always shedding itself and always being replaced from the food that we eat, the water that we drink, and the air that we breathe. That's the reality. But we don't see it. We think, oh, this skin is so nice. Oh, that person's so beautiful. Oh, what nice hair they've got. Hair? Hair just grows. You don't hear the hair on your head say, oh, I'm so nice. I'm in a lovely nice style. No. But it falls out eventually. And it grows and we get it cut and we style it and we think, oh, look in the mirror. don't you look nice? Oh, that's a nice hair. Oh, I've just got a couple of hairs out. Oh, I'm going grey. That's just the nature of the hair. But what do we make of it? We try and make it into something that it's not. Part of the delusion is the way that we look at things. And we look at ourselves in the mirror and we see nothing but delusion. Our teeth. We think, oh, that person's got lovely teeth. Look, we even have special paste now that we can whiten our teeth with to make us look something that we're not. Trying to make our teeth look nice, when in fact they're aging, getting yellow, but we don't like it because we want eternal youth. There, more delusion, more defilement, more kilesa. Eternal youth. Who has eternal youth? You can go into the pharmacy and buy a bunch of products that promise that they will rejuvenate you and keep you going and make you last. Just like that person in the 70s who invented a particular diet and said he was going to live till he's in his hundreds. And was walking along the street and a bolt from a construction site off some scaffolding fell down, hit him in the head, and that was the end of him. So he didn't live till he was in his hundreds. So his creams and his ointments and his diet didn't really make any difference to his longevity. I'm not saying that those things don't provide some comfort or some do work in some way at some level, but they all pander to our ignorance of the way of the world, the way of the world. When we pay respects to the Buddha, we say Namo Tassa. We say Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno. Sukato loka vithu. Now, knower of the world. Knower of the world, in this case, when we talk about the Buddha, doesn't mean that he knows every inch of this earth, that he came to Australia, that he went to America, that he's seen all the sights and knows all the oceans and can find his way around no matter where he is. That's not what it means. What that means is that he understands the way of the world. And the way of the world is that our minds go out and grasp hold of sensory experiences and we can become attached to them. And that attachment, that wanting for them, that craving, the associated attachment, that's what causes us suffering. That's what causes us pain. That's what keeps us caught in the cycle of birth, sickness, old age, death, and rebirth. Without grasping, without wanting for those sensual experiences by the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the skin. Without wanting for those, there is no rebirth. There is no suffering. But we just don't see it. We're just ignorant of the truth. And that's why the Lord Buddha taught the Dhamma, to try and educate us, to try and give us a path that we can learn for ourselves what the true nature of reality is. What the true nature of those kilesas within our heart, what their nature is. Because the heart itself, or the citta, the thinking component of what we call human beings, that in itself is again fleeting. There's no substance to it. Sensory stimulus arise, we perceive them. We make sense of them to whatever sense we can, and we think about them. And we fabricate all sorts of thoughts. And we're conscious through this whole process. But consciousness arises and passes away. Our thoughts arise and they pass away. And they're predominantly driven by the experiences that we have via our senses. So we've already established that our senses part of this conventional world are really fooling us, or at least our interpretation of what we experience through our senses, our interpretation is what fools us. Because again, the eye doesn't set out to deceive. The ear doesn't set out to deceive. The nose doesn't set out to deceive. The tongue doesn't set out to deceive. The skin doesn't set out to deceive. It just does its thing. It plays its part in the way the world works. But somewhere along the line, as we perceive objects via the senses, we make of them something that they're not, these experiences. Some we find pleasurable, some we find painful, some we find neutral. And what we define as pleasure and what we define as pain changes from individual to individual. We can't all agree on what is pleasurable. If you took a straw poll of everybody in this room, you'd find that there will be some things that we would agree on as being pleasurable and some things that we don't agree on. The same for pain, the same for neutral feelings. There is no real definition. We just make it up. When we're born, we're told that we have a certain name. You're born as John, you're born as Mary, you're born... You didn't ask for that name. And certainly the four elements that... the elements that make up your physical body, they didn't ask for that name. And they've got no idea that that somebody's called Mary, somebody's called Jane, somebody's called John, somebody's called Paul. They don't know. We make it up. And then you're told, oh, this is mother, this is father. Yeah, again, the physical elements that make up your body have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. But we hear this, we see these people, and it gets reinforced as we get older and older what we are, how we are to interpret the world. So the odds are against us from the moment that we're born. And we have to try and understand the conventional world and understand the norms that exist in that world. Because by understanding them, we reveal and unravel some of the delusion that sets in our minds. We start to exchange ignorance for wisdom. So how do we do this? Well, of course, we practice giving to start to combat the more gross elements of our defilements. So giving helps to combat things like greed, avarice, jealousy, envy. But on its own, it's fighting an uphill battle. Has to be supported by more subtle levels of practice. And we practice morality, we practice virtue. We keep five precepts as lay people. That's the minimum number of precepts that we can really expect to keep and maintain some protection of our own hearts, our own citta, our own mind. And then we practice meditation. And meditation, of course, is the most subtle of all of those three, because it deals specifically with the mind or with the citta. And it's in there, in the citta, where we find these defilements. We don't find greed in any of the four elements. The air element's not greedy. The fire element, not greedy. The earth element, not greedy. The water element, not greedy. And yet this is what makes up our body. Or we can... Another tool, not just looking at the body as elements, but looking at the body as parts. even if we only stick to the external parts, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, which part of those is greedy? Which part of those gets angry? Which part of those causes us to be deluded? Search through this entire body, no matter how you slice and dice it, you won't find any of the defilements sitting in the body. And yet we think this body is the bee's knees. So what is it that constitutes this body? Because we search for things to comfort this body. We search for wealth. We search for physical possessions. Why? One of the things that we can do to try and understand where the defilements are and therefore how to deal with them is another form of meditation, which we call asupa, or looking at the loathsomeness of the body. Because we, in our normal day-to-day life, we look at the body, as I said, as being pretty, as being beautiful, as being nice, sweet-smelling. To put some weight on the other side of the balance, on the other side of the lever, if you like, we can look at the body as being loathsome. We can look at the body when it dies, as a corpse. If we're feeling particularly lustful, for example, if we have mindfulness, and the key here is having mindfulness, because meditation only works when you're mindful. Having a meditation subject is one thing. Sitting down, crossing your legs, closing your eyes, that's another thing. But having your meditation subject with mindfulness, that's when you practice meditation. So if you have mindfulness and you catch yourself being lustful, for example, you might want to reflect on your own body and see if you can bring up a vision of it in your own mind. And then see what happens when you peel back the skin. See what happens when you stick a knife in your abdomen and open it up and see all your guts inside. Does it look quite so desirable then? Does the person who is the object of your lust, if you do the same to them and see their insides and flay their skin and see all their muscles and sinews and bones, does that body look quite so enticing now? Do you really lust after it? I mean, when you see their intestines and the liver and the spleen and the lungs, when you see them rotting away in front of you, does that really turn you on? Or does it do the opposite? And yet, that's exactly what the body is made of. We like the outside of the body, but most of us don't like the inside. How many people like to watch autopsies? But yet, that's the nature of the body. You won't find many people queuing up to buy tickets to go and see an autopsy. You'll see some, I grant you that. But for most of us, it's something that we'd rather not mention. It's something that might be impolite in nice circles of conversation. Oh yeah, I saw you the other day. I was at you, imagined you in my own mind's eye with all your guts spilled all over the floor. I mean, that's not the sort of thing that comes in normal conversation, is it? And you don't, I'm not saying you have to bring it up either. But what I'm saying is that if you have lust in your mind, then this is one tool that you can use to try and combat that. Because lust, for example, is a defilement which pins you to existence in this world. It's a defilement which, if you don't get rid of it, means you're caught up in this world of birth and rebirth, in this wheel of life, samsara, forever, until you do get rid of it. It's a fire. Lust is a fire that burns within the heart. And it's a fire that really burns, but you just don't feel its heat. If you did, you'd want to get rid of it. You wouldn't want to embrace it. And one of the ways to do that is to practice Asupa meditation. It's a very strong remedy. If you can imagine your body in that way, imagine the body of others in that way. Or you can look at the body from the point of view of the fact that it's going to die. That it is dying from the moment it was born. It's going to die. So if you're greedy, for example, if there's something that you think, oh, yes, or covetous, or envious, if you think, I'm going to die at some stage, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, maybe even my very next breath could be my last. What's the point of wealth? What's the point of possessions? You can't take them with you? Everybody knows that. Yes, oh well, they can comfort me while I'm on, while I'm here in this lifetime. Comfort what? Comfort who? Comfort the body. But we've already said there's nobody in this body. There is no self. There's nothing of any substance to it. So it's just more delusion. But if you surely believe or truly believe in the possible immediacy of death, that it could be, this could be your last breath, then material things don't become so important anymore. Even family and friends you can't take with you. So no matter how much you treasure your family, no matter how much you treasure your friends, ultimately the only thing that you can really treasure is the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. As I mentioned before, the Triple Gem. These are the only things that you can take with you in your heart. Because you can practice the goodness of the Dhamma. You can learn to reduce and finally eliminate the defilements. And that will lead to freedom from suffering. Wealth, family, friends, they won't lead you to freedom from suffering. Nice though they may be, nice though they may seem, ultimately, we have to see them that they are also part of the delusion, part of our attachment to this world, and therefore part of what leads us to more suffering, more rebirth. So we have to develop smart ways of doing things, smart ways of seeing things. As lay people, that's difficult. I'm not pretending that it's easy. But unless we try, we won't get anywhere. The defilements will be just as firm in our hearts now as they were before we started to meditate. So developing, using tools and techniques, which is what we do when we meditate, is really the way for us to gain wisdom and understanding. And as you practice, you'll realize that when you have mindfulness, some of the things that I've spoken about today will appear sharply to the mind, because you've become more concentrated and you see things clearer. And that's when you can develop wisdom. When your mindfulness is good, the first thing that you'll notice is that the kilesa duck for cover. I said to you last week that you should think of them almost as beings in their own right, skillful at what they do. And treat them as worthy adversaries. And when you start to understand their nature, then what they do, the first thing that they do is duck for cover. When your mind is sharp with mindfulness, kilesas are hard to find. That's why you use mindfulness and your meditation subject to become calm and the kilesa become more subtle, but your mindfulness then can match them. Your concentration, the power of your mind can match them. And that's when you can apply wisdom. And that's when you can start to see in clear focus some of the things that I've spoken about today. And that's your real goal. If you want to be liberated from suffering, if you want to practice Dhamma to the end of the path, then this is the kind of training you must undertake. Yes, you can meditate just to be calm. Yes, you can meditate to take away your daily stresses and strains. And that's fine, if that's what you want to do. But last week I said, who's going to take on the challenge? Who's going to swim upstream against the tide? Because that's what Dhamma is. It's the pathway that leads you, gives you the strength that you need, the path, the vision, to swim upstream, to take on the defilements at their own gain. Because that's the path that leads to freedom from suffering. And if you take on the challenge, these are the things that you need to do. That's enough for me. Okay, well. So, some meditation. So as you sit and focus your mind, remember it's mindfulness that you're trying to develop. Without mindfulness, you can become concentrated, but you'll lack the clarity that's necessary to be able to go on to investigate. Some people naturally become concentrated very easily. Sometimes when you sit in meditation, if your mindfulness is not strong, but you can detach yourself to some degree from the senses, your mind can get to a stage where you're just sitting almost indifferently because the mind wants a rest. But without mindfulness as the precursor to that state, getting there is pretty useless, because the mind doesn't come out of that state with any clarity. It doesn't come out being energized. And if that's what's happening to you in your meditation, then you've got to try and find a better way of bringing mindfulness into your meditation. These are the tricks of the trade. This is the skill of a meditator, to be able to find their way through the maze of obstacles that Archelaus throw our way. So we have, each of us, to find our own tricks of the trade. Mind or meditation, no matter what the meditation subject is, relies on mindfulness if it's to be successful. So find a way to make whatever it is that you're looking at more interesting. If you've had the same meditation subject for quite some time and you don't think that you're making any progress, try rethinking the way that you practice. For example, if you practice mindfulness of the breath, as the breath comes in and goes out, where you feel the touch, if you've been practicing that and you don't think that you're making much progress, then you'll eventually become bored and you'll stop doing your meditation. So mix it up a bit. Mix mindfulness on death with your mindfulness of breathing, so that you can see the in-breath begin, have a middle section, and die. So you can see the death of the in-breath gives rise to the birth of the out-breath, and vice versa. The Lord Buddha said that one should see death in every breath. So whatever your meditation subject is, try and find a new angle. Make it more interesting for yourself. And that way you can perhaps bring back some mindfulness. Now we've come to the end of our meditation. Make ourselves comfortable, stretch a bit. Now, before you all rush me with questions, I actually, there was one thing more that I should have said, really, is I concentrated more on greed, lust, because we've spoken about ill will before, but one of the defilements, of course, is ill will or hatred. Covers more than just that, covers being angry, being frustrated, being impatient. And one of the things my teacher, Ajahn Ter, he used to say was that metta is like a cool balm that you can apply to ill will. So if you practice metta, first you must practice metta for yourself. Because if you can't wish yourself to be happy, how can you expect or how can you wish others to be happy? And metta itself, some people think that metta, you radiate metta and you practice loving kindness to all beings and that would be great. But metta doesn't actually work like that. Metta is like a glass or a jug or a bowl. And it's like you pour water in and eventually it fills up and then it spills over and spreads out. The jug or the bowl or the glass is you. It's your own heart. So you should fill this with metta and then let it spread out across the world. Only when you feel happiness for yourself, only when you start to actually understand what real happiness means, only then can you actually spread metta. It's not like you just wish it well for everybody. I mean, that's how you practice when you practice your meditation, wish well for all these people. But first you must concentrate on yourself and top up your own metta and feel your own happiness and feel respect for yourself. Like yourself, or at least like the self that practices the Dharma, the self that's all the defilements, have contempt for that and try and jettison and abandon that because that's real metta. Okay? No, if there are no questions, I've done all the talking. I'm going to have the lights on. That's yours, Lorenz. Over to Bhutan.
Now let us chant the voices of sharing and aspiration.
May the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless, through goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom,
austerity and labor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The good is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary way is my noble Lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.